For more than 20 years, the Oxford Trialists International Overview of Randomized Trials of Breast Cancer has had a major impact on patient care and the design of new trials. The most recent meeting of the trialists took place in late September, and I met with Dr. Peter Ravden the day after he returned from this lengthy but interesting sojourn. Dr. Ravden began by commenting on the overview process.
This is the first pass at this analysis. And up until this point, the analysis has been looked at by statisticians. And of course, when we get together, we find some errors, there's some missing data, so that anything that's presented in the September meeting should be considered preliminary and subject to revision. I don't think the conclusions really are likely to change, but there is that possibility. So I should put that caveat in. I should also say that the process has had a problem over the years, and that is it's taken an exceptionally long time to get the papers out. And last time, actually, it took 5 years, so that the 2000 overview was only really published in May of 2005. So I think that a lot of us feel that discussion of the results, such as they are, is a reasonable thing to do. So I'm not going to give very detailed numbers, but I can tell you what the general gestalt of the process was this time.
You know, it's interesting because we've been talking about the overview in our audio series now, believe it or not, since 1985. And every 5 years, it's the same thing, which is, you know, we can never show any graphics, any numbers, but we talk to people who've been there. And because the papers have been so delayed in their presentation, it's actually sort of this verbal discussion of the initial basic findings, which usually kind of stay the same. They're discussed by people in meetings, et cetera. And sort of that ends up being the way people generally found out about this over the last 20 years, at least have found out about it first.
Right. I think that part of the process needs to be vastly improved. And as a person who's written adjuvant online, a large part of it, a lot of the estimates there have to be based on level one evidence. Of course, I want to see that information out there and disseminated in detail as quickly as possible, because there are things in there that are interesting. One of the things is that, of course, the process has been going on for a long time. And so for a long time, it's focused on tamoxifen and what I would call basically first-generation regimens. And these are dominated by CMF and regimens that were compared to no therapy. And there really isn't any really strikingly new news about the things covered in the old analyses. Basically, tamoxifen for 5 years looked like a good therapy, although, as we'll get to in a moment, obviously we're moving beyond tamoxifen. And that first-generation regimens, now that we have, you know, 20 years of follow-up on those regimens, there's no real surprise. You know, it's not like has been raised in some of the radiation therapy issues that there's some lurking bad long-term toxicity. That didn't show up in the data. I mean, the curves come apart and stayed apart, so the benefits really are maintained over a long time. What was new about this analysis, actually, in terms of chemotherapy, now we have increasing amount of information about clinical trials where basically a first-generation regimen is then compared to a more advanced regimen, or say a more advanced regimen is compared to even more advanced regimens. So some of the questions are, well, how much do taxanes add? Also, what about the subsets of taxane patients? You know, individual trials have suggested with taxanes that maybe they work more in, say, patients with a few nodes rather than many nodes. Individual trials have suggested, and there's been a major paper by Don Barry looking at CLGB results, that maybe these agents work well in estrogen receptor negative patients but don't really add a lot to estrogen receptor positive patients. So those kind of things were addressed by this analysis. And for taxanes, I was actually surprised, although looking at the totality of the data, perhaps I shouldn't have been surprised. One of the things was that for taxanes, first of all, I think it's no surprise that they improved recurrence-free survival of patients, and they improved overall survival, but they were able to do, with the pooling of the data, subset analyses. So they looked at whether or not there was anything by nodes. And in terms of nodes, the node-negative patients and the node-positive patients appeared to be benefiting.
Roughly speaking, what was the relative reduction in risk for recurrence and death for the taxanes over non-taxanes?
It's roughly 20%. So these are trials of an arm that contains a taxane versus one that does not. And there's a mixture of trials here. Sometimes the two regimens are identical, except for the addition of a taxane. If to one of them, that's like 93-44, which is AC times 4 versus AC times 4 plus Taxol times 4. And there were other regimens in there that were different. And that's, you know, regimen with a taxane versus some other regimen. One of them might be the BCRG01 trial, which was TAC-FAC. And so where TAC was better than FAC. So those are actually different regimens being tested against each other. There was very little data for patients who were node negative, but basically that looked positive as well. In terms of estrogen receptor status, and this is, I think, really one of the things after the CLGB paper, something that really a lot of us had an interest in, the estrogen receptor status didn't seem to strongly modulate the benefit. And that, in a way, isn't a big surprise because, you know, if you don't find a correlation with estrogen receptor status, you don't emphasize it. So, for instance, the TAC-FAC trial didn't show a big difference in benefit by ER status. And actually, when you put all the trials together, it didn't look like ER itself would be a predictor of particular benefit for taxanes. So I think those were the bottom line for the taxane trials.
Overall, when you look at the overview data, including the chemotherapy versus control original studies, what has been seen in terms of correlation of estrogen receptor status and impact?
This is a point that was really hotly debated. And the debate centered around whether or not ER was a predictor of particular responsiveness in those patients. This is somewhat complicated by the fact that you really have to, in those first-generation trials, take into account age. And that's because if you're comparing chemotherapy to nothing in young patients, you're seeing not only the cytotoxic effects, but the effects that are due to ovarian ablation in those patients or suppression. So in young patients, ER did not make a difference. And I think that was probably because in the young patients, the ER-positive patients may have had a little less responsive to the cytotoxic effects, but they're getting actually adjuvant endocrine effects as well. So it brings them up. The ER-negative patients and positive patients who were older, however, there did seem to be a difference, at least to my eye. And that is that the ER-positive patients did get benefit, but the benefit was smaller than the ER-negative patients. It was about a 2-to-1 difference. I think that ER is something that is important in therapy, but that its importance is more obvious in the older patients than in the younger patients. Now, that being said, that is the benefit of a regimen compared to nothing. And what I've said about the taxanes is that these regimens were never compared to nothing. They were compared to a regimen that already had caused ovarian ablation in a lot of the patients that were going to experience ovarian ablation. So in those patients, the effects in older and younger patients appeared pretty equal. And irrespective of ER appeared pretty equal, which to me is a little bit of a surprise because I might have expected, you know, that the ER negative patients would have been a little bit more chemosensitive than the ER positive patients. And in fact, what appeared irrespective of age, ER status, was that if anything, the taxanes looked maybe a little bit more effective in the ER positive patients.
I'm sure there are quite a few Europeans there, and we have this whole St. Galen approach that Martine Piccart talked about at the San Antonio meeting. How did they respond to these data? It seems like it refutes a little bit their contention that chemotherapy is not very effective in ER-positive patients.
I think that a lot of people were surprised, and there wasn't a lot of debate. But I think from my view, it was very important not to overly generalize. And that is that you might draw one conclusion when you were comparing chemotherapy versus nothing, and a very different conclusion when you were saying, how could we improve on a therapy? The way that process goes on is that there are very large number of analyses presented and kind of Kaplan-Meier curves. And to be honest, it's somewhat overwhelming. And you're, in the end, given hundreds of pages of analyses. Right now, I'm actually just spending a lot of time in the evenings looking at all these analyses, making up my own slides from them. And sometimes doing that, you actually notice interesting things that were missed in the rush of the data as it was presented.
So would it be fair to conclude that in essence, this finding sort of contradicts the Donberry analysis?
In a way, it does. I think I've heard people state, and I think it's a big inaccuracy, that ER-positive patients, they just don't benefit from therapy, particularly if they're older, and these patients shouldn't be treated with chemotherapy. And I think that that's an oversimplification. I think that it's very important to recognize that those patients do benefit. They may benefit a little bit less. And I will say one thing about them benefiting less. If you're using a first-generation regimen, they actually benefit dramatically less. But if you're using, say, a second-generation regimen that's being compared to a first-generation regimen, but you're thinking about it as the totality of the effect, you know, if you add an equal amount to benefit to both the ER-positive and negative patients, that totality of an effect might be a little bit biased still to more benefit in the ER-negative patients. The difference begins to be obscured by the addition of things that are effective in both groups.
What else is presented there that you think is important for the clinicians to know about?
I will say that the same kind of thing was seen for the question about the addition of anthracyclines. And there was an analysis of high-dose therapy, you know, the old bone marrow transplant trials. That really caused a lot of debate. And one of the things is that it wasn't clear, well, there were some of the trials that the data was not in yet for that are important. In those analyses, although there was a lot of missing ER data that's still to come in, the data that they had on the bone marrow transplant studies suggested that there was a little bit of benefit in terms of the effect of the therapy on recurrence. It wasn't clear that that was a big impact on overall survival, however, because of course, the issues, at least in part, of the toxicity of the regimens. But those analyses might be considered particularly preliminary because data was missing. And I don't think anybody derived any definite conclusions about them. But it'll be interesting to see where those end up. Other things that were discussed is hormonal therapy. And as I've said, there's nothing really brand new about the tamoxifen story, except for one thing. And that is that I think we're all looking forward to the release of information from the big trials of 10 years versus 5 years of tamoxifen. Those trials are still ongoing. They're still blinded.
That's like the Atlas trial and the
Atlas and Adam trial. I think some of that was actually blinded data was added to the analyses of the three very small trials that had looked at it. There were actually 20,000 patients in all that have been in those trials. About 18,500 are in the Atlas and Adam trials. But I think that just kind of reassuring to us American oncologists is the fact that those trials, if they were very positive, would have been stopped. In other words, I think sometimes you can infer, and maybe people would disagree with this, but if a trial in its totality is a very positive trial, say suggesting a survival benefit, as we've seen in the endocrine therapy trials with aromatase inhibitors, the trial stopped. So I think that one can infer that these trials were not strikingly positive with a doubling of the early effect of tamoxifen by giving it twice as long. The other thing I should say about the trials is that the median follow-up of those big trials is between 3 and 4 years now. Patients are still on treatment. And so that's another reason why these trials might be considered very preliminary. So I don't think there's going to be any formal statement unless, for some reason, the information is presented from those trials.
What about the AIs?
The AIs actually are interesting in and of themselves. The proportional benefit for an AI strategy over a non-AI strategy based on tamoxifen was about 20% for recurrence and somewhere around 10% for survival. The AIs, however, I think demonstrate the limitations of an overview. Because if you're a statistician, all AI trials look alike to you. But to clinicians, AI trials really look different. You know, we're really mixing apples and oranges here. Because if you're comparing a trial in which an AI is compared to tamoxifen, and you're adding that data into that great composite figure, and then you're looking at other trials in which, for instance, the use of an AI was compared to no therapy, you're looking at unselected populations at the time of initial diagnosis where those therapies are being applied versus selected populations who have not had a recurrence for 5 years. And so there's a lot of debate about whether or not meta-analysis really adds anything. And there are a number of us, and I must say I myself was one of them, who had a crisis of confidence in the process over the idea that all of these things would be lumped together. The triumph of the meta-analysis, the greatest triumph, I think, was in the 1980s, where a whole bunch of people had done underpowered trials that would have only been positive if these agents had had like 50 to 100% effectiveness. They were like 300 patient trials. And so there were like a dozen of those trials. And they were all negative, but a lot of them showed trends. And so people got together and said, we're doing a disservice to people because none of these trials really answer the questions. We're living in a different era today, an era where now the trials actually have thousands of patients. And I think sometimes when the overview analysis is applied to a bunch of trials in a very general sense, that's not necessarily a good thing. It can actually obscure important differences. I don't think the meta-analysis can ever address the question that a lot of us want to know, and that is the question, well, should I be using an AI up front, or should I be giving 2 or 3 years of tamoxifen and then using an AI? So I think that if you are just want to ask a philosophical question, do AIs help adjuvant therapy of breast cancer? The general answer is yes, they do. But if you want to ask the specific question, is it specifically better than some other regimen? I don't really think that indirect comparisons in an overview meta-analysis answer that question. And those questions are being addressed by very large randomized trials. And in that case, I really think that randomized clinical trial evidence trumps mixing together a lot of, say, generally related but not specifically related trials. One of the things the overview could address is help give us some clues about, say, duration. But direct trials will also, I think, address that well. I think that within the initial 5 years, it's important to give hormonal therapy, and AIs are a little bit better than tamoxifen for postmenopausal patients. Afterwards, the real question is how long to go on.
Was there more data presented from this overview with further follow-up that provides a better feel of the time course of recurrence of ER-positive versus ER-negative?
Yes, there were some interesting results in that regard. If you looked at the trials, particularly the first-generation trials, so you're looking at chemotherapy versus no chemotherapy, there was an interesting result. And the interesting result was, if you looked in any given time period, so you look at, say, the early time period where chemotherapy knocks out recurrences most effectively, interestingly enough, it actually knocked them out in an equal sense in ER-positive and negative patients. And if you looked at the mid-time period, you saw them knocking them out in an equal sense. If you looked at a late time period, although the data begins to get noisy, and amongst other things, the effectiveness against late relapse of those regimens becomes lower in both for ER-positive and negative patients, seem to decrease to about the same level. Now, if you say that, then you say, well, for those first-generation regimens, ER-positive and negative should have benefited equally. But that's not true. And the reason why that's not true is because the ER-negative patients tend to have their relapses in that early time period when the therapy is most effective in knocking out those relapses, whereas the ER-positive patients are tending to have their relapses more toward later, say after 3 years, more of them are occurring. And so those patients, when you look at cumulatively what the impact of therapy is after 10 years, you see a difference, and that is you see that the ER-negative patients seem to get more benefit, and that's because their relapses are occurring. So I think there's going to be some interesting insights that come up from looking at actually the time periods of early versus late relapse. And what I think we already see that there are some important differences between ER-negative and ER-positive patients. Of course, that's been seen before, but the thing that hasn't been really seen, and we don't from individual trials really have enough evidence, is we haven't really seen before that the effectiveness in given time intervals between ER-positive and negative looks rather similar, which to me is a surprise, but does emphasize that the time course of recurrence is very important and is different between ER-positive and negative patients.
Is there a rule of thumb that you can provide to calculate that? And I know you have that in your Adjuvant Online.
Right. I think that in Adjuvant Online, when it does it solely for node-positive versus node-negative patients because it's looking at late relapse as to whether or not you should give hormonal therapy. And in that case, the relapse rates are somewhat higher in node-positive patients than node-negative patients, but they're not as dramatically different as they are during the first time period. And so for node-positive patients, on average, it was about 4% per year. And for node-negative patients, it was about 2% per year.
Okay, let's shift to another topic. You know, I'm curious where things are in terms of your integrating trastuzumab into Adjuvant Online. And I'm sure, you know, it's been more than a year now that those data have come out. What are you thinking at this point in terms of bringing it into adjuvant?
I think it's important to bring it into adjuvant in that, of course, the guidelines and I think clinical common sense suggest that there are patients out there who benefit from trastuzumab. And the fact that the current version, for instance, doesn't specifically mention it almost suggests that adjuvant doesn't take that seriously. One of the reasons why it hadn't been put in immediately was because of the very short follow-up of the trials. You know, actually, some of them only 1 year was presented. Since that time, of course, a little bit more follow-up has been presented. The other thing is the trials have actually been published. So now we can take a look at the numbers as really formalized at the level for publication, not just abstracts. Version 9 of the breast cancer program is about to be released. And it includes now, for the first time, HER2 as one of the parameters that you have to enter in the program. Now, the program doesn't make projections for what the impact of trastuzumab is going to be at 10 years. And that's because we really are looking at data with follow-up of only 2 to 3 years at the moment. And as I've said, in ER-positive patients, a lot of the recurrences are occurring late. And so if you don't know what that part of the story is, you could give wildly inaccurate estimates. So what the program does is it gives separate set of output sheets for trastuzumab, projecting the benefit at 5 years, which I think you can reasonably talk about. Some patients have been followed for 5 years in those trials. They're not the same bar graphs, but they're text graphs that show you that. And there's toxicity sheets as well that discuss some of the toxicities and uncertainties about toxicity so that it will be integrated in the very near future into adjuvant.
So it'll be just another one of these factors that you put it in and it'll change the recurrence rate and the mortality, the projections?
Right. It will also change those as well.
Understanding the caveat of not having that longer follow-up that the other modalities have, what's the number you're going to put in there in terms of relative reduction of recurrence and mortality for trastuzumab?
I think the literature-based estimates for those are basically about 1/3 for mortality and about 50% for recurrence. So those are the numbers that it's going to use.
And it'll be a completely separate variable. It doesn't matter ER, et cetera. It's just going to cut the recurrence rate in half in terms of the numbers.
That's basically right. The one thing that it won't do, and in the future probably will do, you could set it up to do this. But remember that all the trials thus far have not tested the one thing that a lot of us would like to know, and that is what would be the impact of trastuzumab alone? Because for a lot of people, you know, they may not have an enthusiasm about giving chemotherapy. And the limitation of the data limits the program. And that is that we don't have any results as what the impact of trastuzumab alone is. We only have randomized trial results of the impact of trastuzumab when added to adjuvant chemotherapy.
Do you think that those kinds of trials comparing trastuzumab alone to trastuzumab with chemotherapy are going to get done?
I think they will. And the reason why I say that is I think that there is, in some patient populations, an enthusiasm for such an approach. So I think that there would be patients that would consent to that. So I think eventually those trials will get done. They're a little bit problematic in that the patients, most of the populations that we think about trastuzumab being worthwhile in, we also think that chemotherapy is worthwhile in. But I think it's an important question, and I think that there are a sizable number of patients who would like to know the answer to that, as well as the rest of us.
When you take a look at the current generation of adjuvant trials that are out there, what are some of the research questions that you think are going to have the greatest, you know, sort of payback over the next 5 or 10 years?
I think the greatest payback is going to be in the biology. You know, we're incrementally taking these little steps with chemotherapy, and I think maybe that's one of the lessons of the overview. Did taxanes revolutionize things? Well, you know, if you looked at Time Magazine and Newsweek in 1995, the answer would be, oh, yes. But the answer has been, it's been another 20% step. And that's great, but you can take an awful lot of 20% steps before you get anywhere big. There's lots of information now suggesting that we may be able to move really beyond that. The thing that I'm waiting for that I think is now only 6 months to a year away is that there have been trials looking at topoisomerase. And now there are 3 big trials looking at topoisomerase and whether or not they predict benefit of anthracyclines. They don't totally agree with one another. One of them didn't find a significant predictive effect. There is an ongoing meta-analysis of those trials. They include 5,000 patients. That meta-analysis, which actually hasn't been formally done yet, and isn't being done within the context of the overview, it's being done by the 3 separate groups of trialists, that actually is going to be, I think, potentially earth-shaking, because 2 of the topoisomerase studies were very positive and looked very convincing. So I think we're going to be able to tell better which regimens might work in which patients. And of course, there's the Oncotype DX test. I think the other shoe to fall for that test, which may actually further increase its popularity, is the fact that right now we only have the predictive ability of that test for CMF-like regimens given together with tamoxifen, which, of course, nobody's giving CMF concurrently with tamoxifen. And in terms of adjuvant information about, say, whether or not anthracycline-based regimens, it predicts for the benefit of those regimens. We don't have any information from those about Oncotype DX. But that analysis is being done, as I understand it, and should be presented soon. And should it be predictive for the benefit of those regimens, then I think that test will even be more broadly applied to who should and should not get adjuvant chemotherapy.
Roughly what fraction of breast cancer patients are topo II positive?
As I remember it, it's somewhere around 20%. It's somewhat similar number to the number for HER2. And that could mean that for those patients, the effectiveness of anthracyclines is truly spectacularly good.
And conversely, theoretically, if there's not much or any effect in the topo II negative patients, it would bring up the issue of a non-anthracycline regimen. If that happens, what type of regimen do you think people are going to turn to, and what are you going to turn to? We've seen interesting results of the TC, docetaxel cyclophosphamide regimen, that Steve Jones reported. What kind of non-anthracycline regimens do you think people would think about?
Well, I think that those are the kind of regimens that people are going to think about. You know, there are other regimens. For instance, there's also the Taxol carboplatin regimen that was used in the BCRG study. There's continued interest in the effectiveness of 5-FU and the drugs of that general class. So I think that if it should turn out that we can predict who benefits from anthracyclines, and some people don't, there are a number of other agents that could work. This, I think, also will help direct patients toward new agents as well.
Speaking of anthracyclines, I'm curious what your take was on the data presented on anthracycline cardiomyopathy at ASCO.
I'm still actually digesting that information. The issue was, of course, they saw very high levels of anthracycline toxicity, suggestive of, as I remember it, 10 to 20%. And those numbers like that are, of course, different from clinical trial data. And what this actually calls into question in my mind is the biases that occur when there's long-term follow-up. For instance, if you're a clinician, we often lose track of our patients after about 10 years. We're most likely to hear again about them if they have something awful that happens. And also, for instance, an attribution of what that's due to can be biased as well. One of the questions that I have about the overview analysis is the overview analysis is beginning to make statements about the long-term safety of treatments. So they're looking at 20 years and they're saying it is or is not. But there's enormous potential for ascertainment biases out there, both good and bad. And that is that patients that tend to run into trouble you hear about. Other things are, for instance, in some of those trials with radiation therapy versus no radiation therapy, who's following those patients if they didn't get the treatment? And so those patients might be, for instance, vastly underreported in terms of what kind of problems they run into. So I have to say that the presentation at ASCO based on the SEER information and coupling that with the Medicare database is a really big cautionary note that we may be missing late cardiac toxicity. On the other hand, it may actually be biased by reporting issues.
I think the other thing that was kind of interesting about that analysis is the magnifying effect that comorbidities had, for example, hypertension.
They did look at other comorbidities, and yeah, certainly there was some of that. But once again, you know, you have to worry a little bit about ascertainment bias. For instance, if you have hypertension and you're taking drugs for it, then you're more likely to be followed and you're more likely to have events observed. So at any rate, I think that none of us should be completely reassured by that data. And if anything, it emphasizes the importance of long-term follow-up. I would like to point out one thing, and that is that there's really troubling trends on the national level in terms of funding of cooperative groups. Funding has been frozen or decreased over the last few years. This has caused the cooperative groups, even for breast cancer, some of them, to actually stop follow-up at 10 years. And yet we know that relapses, and we know for radiation therapy, what appear to be treatment-related events occur after 10 years, so that for some cancers, maybe for people with testicular cancer, you can forget about following them at 5 years, although even there you could argue the long-term issues of toxicity are important. But certainly in breast cancer, the whole story is not over at 10 years. And, you know, whether or not there's a long-term impact of these agents that is for ill is something we don't really know yet. I would say, by the way, in somewhat in contrast with the data that was presented from the SEER registry, there's been HIMUS's efforts looking at toxicity in older patients. And I haven't seen any big signature of anthracycline-based therapy, although the follow-up is a little bit shorter, and clinical trials have some strengths, but also have their own biases.